the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur, because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. I appreciate you being with us as always, and I think we've got a great show for you. First up today, we have Dr. Philip Glotzbach. He was for about two decades the president of Skidmore College, one of the absolute best colleges in the Northeast. Skidmore was one of the competitors against my college, Middlebury. And so I've been to Skidmore and it is beautiful. Dr. Glotzbach has a new book out on the importance of a liberal arts education. We're going to talk about intentionality in your life and making decisions. We're going to talk about test driving different personalities, which you do in college. I certainly did that in college, to find out who you want to be as a person, as an adult. And it's a fascinating conversation. I'm really sure you will enjoy it. And then we have Nihil Mehta with us. He has been amazingly successful. Five startups that I know of, including, I think, two that had IPOs, and is you just don't get better than that. That's like getting three Oscars in a row, you know, just unheard of. He is also known as the human Rolodex for all of the incredible connections that he has. And we have a great interview about all of that. It is part of our greatest hits series that we are doing now to rebuild a server. We lost a server, it went out of business, the company. And so we lost all of the shows that were put up there, and we're slowly replacing the great ones like the interview with Nihila. So appreciate that. And I want to respond to some of the amazing feedback I'm getting on China. Getting a lot of pushback on my claims last week that China is in the toilet right now. If you're not following it, you need to be. It's not in the American news really at all. But last 2 weeks ago, they had probably the greatest series of natural disasters to ever hit one place. An unbelievable amount of flooding, and it's destroying some of the most biggest infrastructure that we've all been told is irreplaceable. Some of the greatest achievements that humans have ever done, it's crumbling like wet tofu, which is what they call it. They call it tofu architecture. Just 2 days ago, their new super bridge collapsed. 25 people were killed immediately. And we're going to talk more about that in the future, too. Your Christmas is not coming from China this year. The factory is already closed. You're going to hear it first here. You need to buy other stuff. Don't plan on buying from China.
Talk and no action on climate change? Introducing The Real Environmentalists, the bold new book by Jim Beach. It's not about activists, politicians, or professors. It's about the entrepreneurs, real risk takers, building cleaner, smarter solutions, not for applause, but for profit. The entrepreneurs in the book aren't giving speeches. They're in labs, factories, and offices, cleaning the past and building clean products for the future. The Real Environmentalists is available now, because the people saving the planet aren't the ones you think. Go to Amazon and search for Real Environmentalist. Thank you.
We are back. And again, thank you so very much for being with us. You know, we all talk about education, how to fix the American education system. And with AI, we have so many changes coming down the pike. I don't know what to do. Should I send my kids to college or not? I'm excited to introduce someone who can help us learn a little bit more and understand this question. Please welcome Dr. Philip Glotzbach to the show. He was the president of Skidmore College in New York for 17 years and has been a lifelong advocate for liberal arts education. He has just released a new book called Embrace Your Freedom, Winning Strategies to Succeed in College and in Life. Dr. Glotzbach, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Jim, I'm doing fine. Thank you. And thank you for inviting me to have a conversation.
I'm excited. So what is your overall take college good or bad? What's your nuance? How do you want to, what's your thesis?
Well, my thesis is that college is terrific for people who want to go. It's not necessarily for everybody. And goodness knows, in our society, we need well-trained people who are plumbers and auto mechanics and carpenters and lots of other things that you can, careers you can access without going to college. But college is still enormously important. So my thesis is that students need to go to college intentionally. They need to choose it. They need to be intentional about what they're doing to get the most out of it. It's a terrible, terrible opportunity to waste. And unfortunately, our society encourages that, encourages some mistaken ideas, which we can talk about. And also, I think that parents need to support their students in college, not just by writing those checks, but there are some things that they can do. And I talk about that in my book as well.
All right. Let me set a little bit of groundwork for you, Phil. I went to college in the Northeast in Vermont at Middlebury. Spent
great.
God knows how much money. I had enough credit so that I could have graduated after my junior year, but I lied to my parents and said I needed to take some more classes and then dropped classes in the fall so that I would be there in the spring. Cost my parents another 50 grand for no reason other than I just wanted to be in college and hang out and party. I don't know that I learned anything in college at Middlebury. I can't remember anything I learned there. I never went to class. I graduated with a 3.2 or something like that and got an amazing job and ended up in grad school and learned a lot there because I cared. And so when my kids came around, I have four, two have already graduated college and two are still in little kid school. Both of my graduates went to state schools and I didn't pay for very much. They got jobs, they got scholarships, and they worked their butts off and actually learned something. I didn't learn a damn thing in college. You know what? And no one knew. No one figured it out. I scammed the entire Middlebury system. What are your thoughts, Phil, on my little diatribe there?
Well, I've certainly known students like you. I think it might be harder to do that today than it was back then, but it's certainly possible. I just think that, I mean, my approach is, look, this is an amazing opportunity and resource. It's not just a way to spend 4 years and, as you said, for partying or whatever, get drunk and get laid, as sometimes people think. Our society today is very transactional, as we know, and they're pushing an idea that I would call the ATM version of college. You know, you pay your tuition or your parents pay your tuition and fees for 4 years, and you make that deposit, and then after 4 years, you withdraw a certificate and move on to the next part of your life. College is so much more than that. First of all, it is an opportunity to test drive your new adult self, and that means to think about what sort of adult you want to be. What values do you have? What kind of person do you want to be? What do you want other people to think about you, and how do you want to change the world? But the other thing is, it's the one opportunity in life, and I'm sorry that you felt like you didn't get much out of it. I'll come back to that in a minute. But it's the one opportunity that we have to spend 4 years or sometimes more surveying the entire scope of human knowledge. There's just so much out there that one can learn. And you never know in your later life when you're going to use something that you actually did learn in undergraduate school. One of the most important skills that we can have today in the world of work in the 21st century is to be able to connect different areas of knowledge. But coming back to your point, I think you actually did learn more than you are willing to admit from your college experience. You went to Middlebury. I bet you learned how to think more clearly and better. I bet you learned how to read better. I bet you learned some communication skills, writing skills. I hope you did. There are a whole range of things that one should be learning in college. We don't necessarily remember all the content from the courses that we took, but the skills and the mindsets, the attitudes, the abilities that we pick up should be things that stay with us. So that's my commentary on your commentary. What do you think? Did you learn more than you think you did?
Yeah, I was the one who did all of the essays for the entire hall.
Well, you must have been good at it.
Well, you know, I'm very, very good at procrastinating. And because of that, I got good, I think, at actually performing under pressure and getting things done quickly. I don't know. So
Well, that's a skill. That's a skill that carries forward. I don't recommend procrastination, but and it breeds anxiety. And there's a lot of anxiety that students bring with them these days. So, but as you say, it's a skill to be able to work under pressure and to perform. It's called being a professional, being able to do that.
In graduate school, Bill, I did my graduate degree in Hawaii and in Japan. I got a master's of Japanese business. And we were one class that, you know, went through a program together. My roommate and I were number one and number two in the program and, you know, got A's on everything. And we were very, very competitive. And we got to the point where I was not allowed to start the project until he had finished it. And then we would get the same grade. And he would be pissed. So
yeah, I do get that. You know, you're really there's a background assumption here, and you actually mentioned it before. You did very well and you learned a lot in graduate school. Why? Because you were interested.
Yes.
And one of the messages in my book is, look, students need to approach their undergraduate career intentionally and find something to love, and I use that word a lot, in basically everything they're doing. And no matter how boring or off-putting a course seems to be, if you work at it, if you set your mind to it, you're going to find something interesting in there. And if you find something interesting, something that engages you actively, then you're going to learn something from it. But that takes a decision sometimes. And students, I think, need to make those decisions. Again, college is a terrible thing to waste. My God, how much does it cost these days? It costs your parents $50,000 a year. That would be a bargain today for a school like Middlebury. And of course, there's, you know, students graduate with debt, and some of the recent developments in the federal government are going to make it even harder to afford college. So it's really an investment. We can't afford, either as an individual or as a family or as a society, that we put into a college education. And I'm not just talking about the monetary return. I'm talking about learning things that will stay with you for life. I mean, you deal with entrepreneurs. And your podcast talks with people who've started up businesses and so on. How many times have you found out that somebody ends up working in a field 5, 10, 20 years out of college that wasn't even imagined when they were in college? That's the world we live in today. You have to be able to continue to learn. You have to be able to continue to do things like I mentioned before, connecting different areas of knowledge. Ted Turner was a classics major, and then he became an economics major at Brown, and he started CNN. You know, what's the connection?
Yeah, but he cheated his entire way through, so.
Well, that's not good, and I talk about that in my book. And, you know, it comes back to the question of what sort of adult do you want to be? You know, would you like to go to a cardiologist who cheated his way through medical school? Or how about going to a lawyer who cheated her way through law school? How would you feel about that if you knew about it? I think that students need to ask themselves that kind of a question. Again, what sort of adult do I want to be?
You know, so I'm going to push back on the intentionality, because I don't see this generation has intentionality. They seem lost to me. You know, they don't want to drive when they're 16. You know, you're supposed to be dying to drive when you're 16. And this generation is like, yeah, you can keep driving me around.
Well, I have a grandson.
What are your thoughts on this generation? I don't see the intentionality there. Maybe I'm just curmudgeon now, Phil. What do you think?
Well, Jim, you know what? I'm becoming a curmudgeon, too, in my old age here. And I suspect I'm a lot older than you are. But I remain optimistic. I have a grandson who's 16 years old, and he can't wait to. He has his learner's permit now. He can't wait to get his driver's license. So there's at least one counterexample. You know, every generation looks problematic to the older generation. You can go back to Roman and Greek writings and find people decrying the young people of today, how they're worthless and they don't care about anything. One of the reasons I wrote this book, I mean, this book is a labor of love for me. I've spent 5 decades in higher education, and I think I've observed a number of things over the years, and I think I've learned a few things. And it's really a challenge to new students to find that intentionality. I don't know how many 18-year-olds really have that level of intentionality when they start out. There's a huge difference between being a freshman and a senior. But my book says, you know, you can start thinking about that right away. And if you do, you really can create for yourself a richer college experience, something that enables you not to waste this opportunity. It's a terrible thing to waste.
Can you go through the 8 steps to a highly successful life that you have in the book?
Sure. I mean, really, it's the chapters that are chapters 2 to 9. The first one is Embrace Your New Freedom, title of the book, and that is to understand freedom in a deeper sense. We don't do a very good job in our society of understanding that key concept. We can come back to that if you want. Next one is Make No Small Plans. This is a moment in your life when you really do need to think about what you might do if you knew you could never fail. I would suggest people ask that question. What can I do if I knew I could never fail? And start thinking about that. The next chapter is called Essential Equipment Part 1, Your Body. And it really just reminds students of a lot of things that they probably already know, but sometimes college students can lose sight of. You need to take care of your equipment, your body. And that involves not destroying yourself through binge drinking and drugs and stuff like that. But there are also some other things involved. What about sex in the post-Roe v. Wade world? The next one is Essential Equipment Part 2, Your Emotional Life, Mind, and Spirit. There's a lot of conversation these days about the attitudes that our young people bring to college. There's clearly more anxiety and depression and all of that. And there are resources that colleges and universities provide. But my challenge to them is to take charge of your emotional life, just like I challenge them to take charge of their physical life. And the chapter talks about that. The next chapter is titled Take Good Risks. I'm trying to say that, look, just because I've talked about taking care of yourself doesn't mean that you should be a turtle and pull your head into the shell. No, this is a time when you should take some risks, but take the right kinds of risks. Take some intellectual risks. Take a course that really kind of scares you. Do some things that challenge you. Push yourself. That's the way to achieve excellence in your life in college and then afterwards. The next one is practice giving back and paying it forward. The American educator Horace Mann once said, be ashamed to die until you have won some victory for humanity. Again, this is something that we don't necessarily talk about today, but I ask students to ask that question. What victory do you want to win for humanity? Going to college is an enormous, enormous privilege. Only about 40% of American population have a college degree. And if you look at the world, it's probably 10%. So even just being in college is an enormous privilege. So what are you going to do with that? The responsibilities come with that. Practice giving back and paying it forward. Think about that. What kind of victory do you want to win for the world? The last chapter in this section is called Begin Now. And for a while, that was the working title of the book. I think that's one of the most important things. When I used to speak to new students and their parents at the beginning of the academic year every fall, which is where this book came from, those talks, I said, look, if you forget everything else I've said, remember this. College starts on the first day you arrive, not next semester, not next year. You know, I've talked with and encountered too many students who make the mistake of not beginning immediately, and they regret it later on. The last thing you want to do at the end of your college career, or if you have an interrupted career because you flunk out or whatever, is to look back and say, you know, I really could have done better if I had started at the very first day. And that's an important thing, I think, for students to remember. So those are the 8 steps, and those are my suggestions. They're very concrete, but it asks students to think about their college career in terms that go beyond just getting that first job, which is not unimportant. I don't deny that. But you're also working to prepare yourself for life later on, for a whole career of working and a career of citizenship, by the way.
It seems like this generation is having a much harder time getting that first job. I see articles about that all the time. What's wrong with them? They seem just like I was 50 years ago or whatever, 25, 30 years ago, 45 years ago to be exact.
But who's counting?
Yeah, who's counting? You know, they don't seem to be getting to be making that first step successfully. Do you disagree?
Well, I think that there are a lot of students who do and probably some that don't and who struggle, and that's not entirely their fault. The economy is challenging in all kinds of ways, although I think there are jobs out there. There are things students really can do to position themselves for that first job. The first thing they can do, I say, is to choose a major that, number one, you're good at. You need to have some ability there and something that sparks your interest. Studies have shown it's very clear that we all do better with intrinsic motivation than extrinsic motivation. If you're choosing a major just because you think it might help you get a good job, you're not going to do as well as if you choose a major where you're actually interested in it. But regardless of what major you choose, and by the way, only about 30% of college graduates end up working in the area that they studied. So, you know, choosing a major is probably less important than sometimes people think it is. But regardless of what you can do, you can pursue internships during your college career. There are more of them available today. Schools stress that. It's a great way to dip your toe in the waters of a particular kind of job or whatever. And oftentimes an internship can lead to that first job. Students can pursue courses that get them out into their community, service learning courses, community-based learning courses, which, again, give students practical experience out in their communities along with what they're learning in the course, the course content. And then they need to learn how to talk about what they have learned in college for future employers or grad school admission deans and so on, if you want to go on to that. One of the things that's enormously helpful for students is to have an experience before they graduate of doing at least a one semester or two semester independent research project, because that's something, a concrete accomplishment that you can talk about with future employers. My son went to medical school and he was a history major, and he did his senior thesis on the development of medicine in the Civil War, a fascinating topic. And that essay provided something for him to talk about with for medical school admissions committees, and that helped him get admitted to medical school. And by the way, it's very hard to get admitted to medical school. So there are a lot of things that students can do. Of course, networking, using the Career Development Center at the college or university, networking with alumni from their college or university. They need to be, again, intentional about this, and the career development people will tell them they should be visiting the Career Center, not just the second semester senior year, but they should be coming in freshman year to start thinking about how they can present themselves to the world. What does a resume look like, and so on. So again, intentionality. Students need to think about what they want to do and take the steps that will help position them to do it.
Phil, I'm a Southerner, and we were raised that you're only supposed to be in the newspaper three times: when you're born, when you die, when you get married. And it seems like my institution, Middlebury, is only in the news for beating up visiting professors or rioting or something like that.
Yeah.
It seems like education right now has lost its
mojo.
You know, that is a word that I thought, I dismissed it.
I like that word.
I like that word too. You know, we didn't go to college to protest when I was there. That never happened once, you know, and now it seems like a lot of these kids are getting degrees in protesting. What are your thoughts on the changes in liberal arts education over the last 10, 20 years? To me, it looks like it's going downhill. Y'all are wasting a lot of time on campus.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're talking to a guy who went to school during the Vietnam era. I went to college in 1968, graduated in 72, and I did some protesting during that time. I also graduated summa cum laude. The two are not mutually exclusive. I do think that that protesting represents a reasonable and important, valuable understanding that the world is not perfect and we could do better about things, and raise your voice to say, to express your opinions. I agree with a number of educational leaders who are starting to say, you know what, protesting is terrific, peaceful protesting. We cannot have protests that disrupt the educational process or make it impossible for others to pursue their education. Or I would say, if we have invited a speaker to campus, it is not acceptable for students to exercise what sometimes is called the heckler's veto, to shout that person down and keep that person from speaking. That is not acceptable. It's antithetical to the purpose and the fundamental values of an academic institution. And I think schools need to be clearer about that. And that's the first step towards helping them rediscover their mojo. The second thing is to help students understand what protesting means. And by the way, help them understand the concept of civil disobedience. It was so important for Martin Luther King. A key aspect of civil disobedience says if you choose to do something which breaks a law or breaks a rule of the university, a significant rule, then you need to be prepared to take the consequences. Civil disobedience is actually a moral action which says, I'm going to force you to punish me for this, but you need to be prepared to take the punishment. And so civil disobedience without consequences is not civil disobedience in my book. And that's so students need to be clearer about that. I think that so there's a role for protest, but I do think that, again, if students are intentional about what they're doing, I apologize for repeating this, that they need to understand why they're there for those 4 years, what they expect to get out of it. And they need to pay attention to what they're learning inside and outside the classroom. Now, can you learn a lot through protesting and through being involved in movements that are trying to change the world? Sure you can. And I could, talk about that at more length. But the bottom line is know what you want to get out of your college education. And I can say what you're paying for as well.
All right. Last question. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, if schools were clear about all these things, and it's very easy for me to speak as a former president, easier for me to be clear about it now, perhaps, than even when I was in office. That is a really important step towards recovering some of the respect that has been lost for colleges and universities through the negative press that they've received, sometimes reasonably and sometimes unreasonably. Notice that institutions in this country have all suffered declines in public confidence. We need to work on that as a society, and colleges and universities absolutely need to work on that, recovering confidence.
Why is it acceptable to give a dance degree or a minority linguistics degree or some of these crazy things I've seen that in no way can prepare that student for the bills of adult life? Why are we giving out degrees that won't support people?
Well,
isn't that your obligation?
I would disagree with your premise. Let me give you one example, whether you agree with his politics or not. Rahm Emanuel was a dance major at Sarah Lawrence College, and he, you know, was Obama's chief of staff and mayor of Chicago and so on. Again, 30% of people go on and work in an area from their major. But what you learn along the way are a set of skills that can help you make your way in life and find that career path that is the one that you're meant to find. So I would disagree with the notion that the only majors we should offer are ones that have a direct line to some job when you're finished. And in fact, some of the majors that people have thought to be the most useless in that sense, like art history or say philosophy, which is my major, actually turn out to be great ways to prepare yourself for doing things later on. And if you look at, say, Fortune 500 CEOs, the humanities and even theater are way overrepresented. People who study those kinds of things, English, philosophy, dance, theater, tend to do better in life.
But those are real. I don't have a problem with any of those degrees. Even theater, I don't have a problem with. I have a problem with the niche. We're getting a lot nichier than that nowadays, you know?
Yeah. It's a reasonable objection, and I think schools can look at that. Those niche degrees are really reflections of faculty interest. And I would agree. I've never been president of a major university that has that whole range of those kinds of things. But I think every college and university needs to interrogate what it's offering to students. But it's very difficult to say sometimes, you know, what the long-term value of a particular degree is, because, again, what students are learning in that program goes well beyond the content if everybody's doing their job right.
Bill, congratulations on the book. How do we find out more, follow you online, all that, please, sir?
Well, thank you very much again, Jim, for having me on. There's more information available on my website, www.philipglotzbach.com, and that's one L in Philip, so there's a lot of information there. My book's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Simon & Schuster. My publisher is Post Hill. Any of those websites can give you access to the book. My website has links to reviews and other things I've written and speeches I've given and so on, if somebody wants to find out a little bit more. So there's a lot of information about the book there, and there are reviews that continue to come out and the podcast. And again, I really appreciate your having me on. So that's what I'm trying to do to get the word out.
Yes, I understand. All right. We are out of time. Thanks a lot, Philip.
Thank you, Tim. Very much enjoyed our conversation.
And we will be right back.
I think it's a great question.
It's great question.
Yeah, that's a really good question.
Okay, that's a great question.
And
those are two great examples. Great, Jim.
Jim, I think that's absolutely perfect. That is exactly it.
School for Startups Radio.
And welcome back to School for Startups Radio. Again, thank you so much for being with us today. I am very excited and honored to introduce you to my first guest. His name is Nihal Mehta, and this resume is unbelievable. You're going to be blown away. He is currently the founding general partner of ENIAC Ventures. He has started 5 startups. He has invested in over 100 startups. One of his companies was called Local Response. It was number 204 on the fastest growing company list in Inc. magazine. He was also number 67 in the Forbes list of America's most promising companies. He was a semifinalist for the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year, top 100 coolest people in New York tech by Business Insider, a NYC tech influencer by VentureBeat, and a ton of other accolades. It's just amazing. He specializes mostly in mobile things, so we will start there. Nihal, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being with us. Are we to the point now where mobile is everything? Is there still a distinction between mobile and non-mobile? Aren't we to the point where mobile is the entire game?
Yeah, mobile is the entire game. Mobile is more than the entire game. It's pretty exciting, actually. Every conversation that I have now with with investors, with entrepreneurs, absolutely everything is mobile. It's very, very different than it was, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and certainly 20 years ago when we first started.
5 years ago when you sat down to build a new website, you would get a graphic designer or some sort of designer to show you what it was going to look like on the desktop in front of you. Should we even skip that now and go, what's it going to look like on my iPad? Should we start there now?
Yeah, I mean, I would even say tablets are probably, that form factor is kind of obsolete. You definitely start mobile first. Obviously I'm biased. You don't have to take it just from me, but I think mobile first makes a ton of sense. In other parts of the world, like in India, you have large services. For example, the competitor to Amazon, one of the competitors, Flipkart, they just turned off their desktop site completely. So literally, 95% of their transactions happen on mobile. They said, screw the website, we're going to get rid of it. So it's not only about developing, mobile first and investing in it, but, I think desktop is desktop, been there, done that, time to move on.
Well, that presents a whole new design challenge, doesn't it? I mean, designing for a iPhone 5 or something like that, that's a pretty small surface area to start with, isn't it? Isn't it too small to be your primary source of information?
Yeah, well, I think what people are realizing is that you can't just stuff, a desktop web page into mobile screen size proportions, right? And I think, we made a lot of mistakes as an industry. One, for example, is advertising, right? So the banner ads that came from newspapers made their way online in terms of keeping kind of the relative proportions the same. Now, unfortunately for mobile, folks tried to keep the same proportions as well on those banner ads from desktop and put them into mobile. And what happened is that we had a lot of, we call it the fat thumb, fat finger syndrome, where you're accidentally clicking on banner ads because these ads are so freaking small on the mobile device. And so that is not, you know, the optimal format for mobile ads. And I think from the advertiser perspective, things are changing now with video and full screen takeovers and push notifications and, you know, Bluetooth notifications. There's a lot of other much more engaging ad mediums that are just unique to mobile. And I think, you know, going back to your original question in terms of just developing, you know, a website for mobile, the same types of considerations are now happening. So you're not just literally cramming in, you know, a huge, you know, long scrolling, you know, desktop website with lots of tables and pictures on mobile. That doesn't work that way, right? What you would do is, the latest thing kind of in the past few months is something called Cards, C-A-R-D-S, on mobile. And these, it's just a very easy way to swipe through content, similar to kind of how users are flocking to the, you know, the Tinder-like interface, right, where you kind of swipe left, swipe right. So swiping through content has now become, you know, one of the more interesting user interfaces to consume content on mobile. But that's just one example of how things need to be reformed, you know, to the mobile screen size.
You know, I hate ads on mobile. When they pop up, I make a mental list to avoid that company in the future because it always just pisses me off. What about, or what do you see as the best ad platform for mobile then? Is it using a card scenario where one out of every eight cards, one out of every five is an ad and you just swipe through it? Or what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think bottom line, ads should be content. You know, the consumer should want that ad. And I think we're getting there. We're definitely not there yet. So it doesn't seem like a nuisance. So it's not even like one out of five, one out of 10. It's when you see it, you actually want it, right? It's something that's contextual, something that's intelligent, that knows exactly what you want, right? So an example is, we're coming up on lunch. You know, your phone knows a lot of things about you, right? It's the ultimate sensor. It actually knows what restaurants you've been to, what you've ordered on Seamless, you know, how often you get coffee every day. In fact, what time you eat lunch, what time do you get out of your desk, you know, walk with your phone, you know, to your neighborhood Chipotle or whatever it might be to get lunch. So we're coming up on lunch, right? Imagine I get right now a push notification on my phone that says, hey, it's Friday, it's 12:30, you're probably hungry. Last Friday, you had tacos. You want to get tacos again? And literally you just swipe right to confirm, and 15, 20 minutes from now, boom, your lunch arrives, right? Technically, that's an ad, right? That's something that potentially that taco shop or Chipotle, what have you, could pay to advertise for, you know, to drive that transaction. For you, that's perfect, right? It's personalized, and it's intelligent, and it's coming to you at the right time. And I think that's where advertising has been going kind of over the past few decades, where it actually becomes content. And with mobile now, we have the opportunity to deliver on that promise.
Okay. Even then, I don't want the taco ad. You know, does it come with a discount?
Yeah, it can come with a discount. You know, I think the point of, again, of these ads is to make it seem like it's not an ad, right? So if it's not like, all right, forget the taco ad. Maybe you don't want tacos today, but
all right, let me interrupt. I had a baby girl last week. Okay.
Okay. If the congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. It was my fourth child, so I'm marginally excited. I'm 47, so I need another baby, like another hole in the head. But nevertheless, if anything came up there about baby girl stuff, I would at least pay a half second of attention. But yep. If it didn't come with a discount, I'm probably still going to add it to my checklist of companies to avoid because they interrupted my life, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's got to come with some sort of discount, or otherwise I'm still going to be offended by it. What do you think?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. You know, I think there needs to be some incentive, you know, and some motivation for a user to click on it. You know, remember, every free content, anything that's free, you know, is free because it's ad supported, right? And your newspaper is free because it's ad supported. Actually, some people even pay for newspapers still, which is crazy, but and there are ads on it. But you know, your TV is free. Well, not really, because you're paying your cable provider, but you know, subsidized largely by ads, by TV commercials. And so I think, you know, listen, you're going to have ads, but these ads are going to become a lot more contextual, a lot more personalized. Yes, they will have discounts. They'll have some sort of incentive. The format will be better. It's not going to be little tiny banner ads. It's not going to annoy you. You can turn them off if you want. But I think the vision is it's going to enhance your experience. So, you know, your phone should know you had a baby girl because, you know, you're at the hospital.
Got 20 pictures of the, yeah, it's got a bunch of pictures on there. Yep.
And there's a bunch of pictures on there. Exactly. Right. And so, you know, I just had a son as well 3 months ago and there's this amazing newsletter I get every week. You might've heard of it called Lucy's List. I think it's meant for moms, but I hijacked the list and I might be one of the few dads that gets it, but sign up for it. It's amazing. Essentially every week it tells you, you know, what's going on. Of course, this is your fourth. So you know, but I had no clue. And every week they're changing so much. And it's like, you know, in week four, you know, your baby should be sleeping longer than, you know, 3 hours at a time. And you might want to, you know, try this. And it's like this amazing snap and go for your car seat, right? Or whatever it might be.
Right.
And it's so well targeted at that time for me. And I literally just buy everything that comes on that newsletter. And so, you know, your phone should know that it's been a week and you're probably exhausted. And so here's something that might, you know, here's a coffee or here's something that might help you in your situation right now. And I think, you know, again, ads need to be so targeted that it enhances your experience, that it should not piss you off at all. It should not make you angry at all. You should say, it's like the Dos Equis commercial on TV. Right. Every time you see that, you laugh or I laugh. Right. Because it's funny. It's content. And that's what the experience should be, you know, on your phone at all times.
Well, congratulations on your baby son. Let me throw out one book to you. There's a book called Baby Wise by Gary Ezzo, E-Z-Z-O, that teaches parents how to teach their babies how to sleep through the night by 2 or 3 months. It's an amazing.
Yep, I'm actually holding it right now.
Oh, good grief. That's so ironic. It's the best book ever. You know, as you know, with my fourth kid now, I swear to you, it works. I have a 17-year-old and he can be in the car and say, Dad, I'm going to take a nap for an hour and then go to sleep, put himself to sleep in like 30 seconds. It's amazing. I'm so happy that you're reading that book because it's made my life and the life of my wife so much better. So anyway, let's, you know, there's a free ad for Baby Wise by Gary Ezzo. We should send him a bill. All right. So I agree with you. It should be all of that perfect. Where are we? What grade do you give the advertisers, including yourself, of the world? Are we even to B- yet? I feel like we're still in the low C's. What grade would you give us?
Yeah, I agree. I think we're in the low C's as well. I think a lot needs to change. You know, the one thing we've been waiting for is just consumer usage on devices, on smartphones. We've been waiting for this for, you know, 20 years. And since the iPhone came out, I think it's been a game changer. It's made, you know, the smartphone, which is now just the normal phone, really, it's made it mass market. Everybody has it. And this is not just an American phenomenon. It's everywhere around the world. And I think that's the first and the most important thing is to have a lot of consumers on it, right? It's like the internet of like 1998. We had great companies, but there was nobody on the internet, right? There's nobody doing commerce. So then the bubble burst and the great companies went away. You know what? Those great companies are back again because there's real users behind them. The ideas are actually very similar to what the ideas were 20 years ago, but we finally have consumers doing it. So I think that's one thing we're waiting for is to get billions of folks on phones every day using data, right? Now it's about applications that are just that enhance our lives. I think one example is Facebook. Facebook today has close to or maybe even over a billion users on mobile every day, a billion active users every day on mobile, right? Including the Instagram property, it's probably over a billion. Now, when you use Facebook, obviously you're on mobile. I feel like everybody does for at least half an hour, especially everybody with kids. That's like the best form of like self-confidence, like reinforcement, posting a picture of a kid and then just getting like,
oh, he's so beautiful. Like, oh, he's so beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. Getting like 200 likes. Whenever you're feeling blue, just post a picture of you with your kid and you get like 200 likes in like a minute. And then you're at the top of the world. But, so obviously you have that obvious engagement, but now within the newsfeed, you're starting to see, a lot more targeted advertising. These ads can actually read what apps are on your phone, maybe even what apps you use and what apps you don't use, so that other apps can target you, and you can literally click to install, which has been a pretty big revenue driver for Facebook and Twitter. Video, obviously, consumption is just taking off like wildfire. Folks are posting video content, and that auto plays in the news feed, so it's very addictive. But the same go with commercials. So just like TV commercials are on TV, now you start seeing them in Facebook news feeds. And a lot of them are really engaging. And so you sit there and you watch, and, it knows, these advertisers know who you are, know where you've been, know the apps on your phone, so they can provide, much, much more granular targeting than television. So we're getting there. I'd say we're still in the seas, because I think only a few companies are doing it well. Facebook's doing it well. Twitter's doing it well. Snapchat's starting to do it well. These guys are realizing that the medium is video. That's really engaging to consumers. Well-produced, video ads, like we're all familiar with television. I think Google with YouTube is getting there as well. But there's a lot of other crappy platforms, crappy apps, crappy advertising experiences that need to get a lot better.
On the other hand, I'm concerned about privacy. I don't want you to know that I ate tacos last Thursday, because you'll then tell my insurance company, who will then jack my rates because I didn't eat a salad.
Right.
I'm concerned about the other direction, and I'm concerned that my children don't seem to be concerned at all about their privacy. What are your thoughts on this very delicate balance between cool responsiveness versus cool invasions of privacy that aren't very cool?
Yeah. I think, one point you mentioned, there's such a generational divide with respect to privacy. Kids don't care, right? Like when Twitter came out, the first tweets were like, I'm in the bathroom. It's like, yeah. Literally there's complete apathy, and even folks, much younger than myself, this is their chance to kind of be digital narcissists, right? This is their chance to be that celebrity in their own world. And so they're oversharing everything, and they certainly don't care. I think it's very important to, as a brand, as a publisher, to always maintain privacy, by default. So I know Facebook has had some controversy over the years, but now I think everybody's starting to realize is, listen, make sure that you don't let anybody access, any private information by default. And if consumers want to change those defaults, that's fine. But the default should be that, this information is not getting shared at all. And that's very fair. And I think, the FCC has done a good job enforce that, at least in the U.S., and that's now become the standard. So you don't have to worry about that, in terms of getting that taco ad, unless you actually give the app permission to dig into your calendar, right? To dig into your GPS, right? And I've given a lot of apps calendar access, and GPS access, because I actually have a much better experience now from what I have to do. One example is if I have a meeting in 20 minutes and it might be 15 minutes away, say by car, in 5 minutes, I'll get a reminder that says, hey, you know, we have a meeting in 15 minutes and you got to leave now. So what we've done is we've called you an Uber and it's downstairs and it's completely automated. And I get into the Uber and it already has the address plugged in. And you don't have to think twice and boom, I'm at my location. Right. But of course I had to give up some privacy there. Right. I had to make sure the app had permissions to access my calendar and GPS. But because I did that, you know, I had this magical experience. And so I think people are starting to realize that there's some benefits involved to allowing apps to access private information. Of course, you got to be sure that those apps don't then resell that information or use that information for anything else, which rarely happens, but you got to be careful about that. But now there's real benefits to allowing, you know, other companies to have this information. So I'm on the extreme side. I'm probably like your typical 9-year-old on Snapchat or Instagram. I say, you know, I don't care about privacy. You know, like apps like surprise me with some magic, like that Uber example. And I think there's going to be a lot more of that in the future.
Well, let's let the listeners know that you are an investor in Uber and Airbnb. If I came to you and said, I'd like you to invest in my company, it's an amazing idea. But in my presentation, I don't once mention mobile. At the end of the presentation, you ask and you say, what about mobile? And you go, yeah, we'll be mobile enabled. Do you invest in that company or not?
No. And I probably would not have taken the meeting because I would have gotten the deck beforehand and realized it wasn't mobile. And told you, you know, we have a very specific focus in mobile first. Most investors don't have that focus. So most investors, you know, would probably still consider it. We're very focused on mobile first because that's where our backgrounds are from. That's where our experience is. That's where we can help companies the most.
All right. Well, fantastic stuff. I love it. I want to throw out, I know your wife is going to want your next baby to be a girl. So I want you to read Landrum Shettle's book, How to Choose the Sex of Your Baby. It works. I'm 4 for 4 with it. I am boy, girl, boy, girl. All 4 of my children were sex selected 100% naturally using the book, How to Choose the Sex of Your Baby. Just wanted to throw that out to your wife, really.
Now that is a great ad, Jim. That was like a perfectly targeted ad because we're talking about it, about having the next child. She definitely wants a girl. So that for example was perfectly targeted.
Nice Landrum work. Shettles, if you you should call and let him know so that I get my 18 cents. How of can course. We learn more about you, follow you on social media, follow you on your mobile device? How can I get to see what's on your mobile device?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter, at Nihal Mehta, N-I-H-A-L-M-E-H-T-A. My fund is called ENIAC, named after the world's first computer. It's just ENIAC.VC, ENIAC.VC. You can check out some of the companies we've invested in. If you have any questions, if you have a business plan, if you want to yell at me about privacy, just tweet at me again, at Nihal Mehta, and I'll get back to you pretty quickly.
Fantastic. I'd like to go get a taco with you. Nihal, thank you so much for being on the show. Fantastic stuff. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Jim.
We are out of time for today, but back tomorrow. Be safe, take care, and go make $1 million. Bye now.